This is Audible.
Blackstone Audiobooks presents The Denial of Death by Ernest Becker. Dedication. To the memory of my beloved parents, who unwittingly gave me, among many other things, the most paradoxical gift of all, a confusion about heroism. Non ridere, non lugere, neque detestare, sed intelligere. Not to laugh, not to lament, not to curse, but to understand. Spinoza. Forward. The first words Ernest Becker said to me when I walked into his hospital room were, "You are catching me in extremis. This is a test of everything I've written about death. And I've got a chance to show how one dies, the attitude one takes, whether one does it in a dignified, manly way, what kind of thoughts one surrounds it with, how one accepts his death." When The Denial of Death arrived at Psychology Today in late 1973 and was placed on my desk for consideration, it took me less than an hour to decide that I wanted to interview Ernest Becker. On December 6th, I called his home in Vancouver to see if he would do a conversation for the magazine. His wife, Marie, told me he had just been taken to the hospital and was in the terminal stage of cancer and was not expected to live for more than a week. Unexpectedly, she called the next day to say that Ernest would like to do the conversation, if I could get there while he still had strength and clarity. So I went to Vancouver with speed and trembling, knowing that the only thing more presumptuous than intruding into the private world of the dying would be to refuse his invitation. Although we had never met, Ernest and I fell immediately into deep conversation. The nearness of his death and the severe limits of his energy stripped away the impulse to chatter. We talked about death in the face of death, about evil in the presence of cancer. At the end of the day, Ernest had no more energy, so there was no more time. We lingered awkwardly for a few minutes, because saying goodbye for the last time is hard, and we both knew he would not live to see our conversation in print. A paper cup of medicinal sherry on the nightstand mercifully provided us a ritual for ending. We drank the wine together, and I left. That day, a quarter of a century ago, was a pivotal event in shaping my relationship to the mystery of my death, and therefore my life. I will carry for a lifetime the images of Ernest's courage, his clarity purchased at the cost of enduring pain, and the manner in which his passion for ideas held death at bay for a season. It is a privilege to have witnessed such a man in the heroic agony of his dying. In the years since his death, Becker has been widely recognized as one of the great spiritual cartographers of our age, and a wise physician of the soul. Gradually, reluctantly, we are beginning to acknowledge that the bitter medicine he prescribes, contemplation of the horror of our inevitable death, is, paradoxically, the tincture that adds sweetness to mortality. Becker's philosophy, as it emerges in Denial of Death and Escape from Evil, is a braid woven from four strands. The first strand. The world is terrifying. To say the least, Becker's account of nature has little in common with Walt Disney. Mother Nature is a brutal bitch, red in tooth and claw, who destroys what she creates. We live, he says, in a creation in which the routine activity for organisms is tearing others apart with teeth of all types, biting, grinding flesh, plant stalks, bones between molars, pushing the pulp greedily down the gullet with delight, incorporating its essence into one's own organization, and then excreting with foul stench and gases the residue. The second strand. The basic motivation for human behavior is our biological need to control our basic anxiety, to deny the terror of death. Human beings are naturally anxious because we are ultimately helpless and abandoned in a world where we are fated to die. This is the terror. To have emerged from nothing, to have a name, consciousness of self, deep inner feelings, an excruciating inner yearning for life and self-expression, and with all this yet to die. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and Ernest Becker were strange allies in fomenting the cultural revolution that brought death and dying out of the closet. At the same time that Kubler-Ross gave us permission to practice the art of dying gracefully, Becker taught us that awe, fear, and ontological anxiety were natural accompaniments to our contemplation of the fact of death. The third strand. Since the terror of death is so overwhelming, we conspire to keep it unconscious. The vital lie of character is the first line of defense that protects us from the painful awareness of our helplessness. Every child borrows power from adults and creates a personality by introjecting the qualities of the godlike being. If I am like my all-powerful father, I will not die. So long as we stay obediently within the defense mechanisms of our personality, what Wilhelm Reich called character armor, we feel safe and are able to pretend that the world is manageable. But the price we pay is high. We repress our bodies to purchase a soul that time cannot destroy. We sacrifice pleasure to buy immortality. We encapsulate ourselves to avoid death. And life escapes us while we huddle within the defended fortress of character. Society provides the second line of defense against our natural impotence by creating a hero system that allows us to believe that we transcend death by participating in something of lasting worth. We achieve ersatz immortality by sacrificing ourselves to conquer an empire, to build a temple, to write a book, to establish a family, to accumulate a fortune, to further progress and prosperity, to create an information society and global free market. Since the main task of human life is to become heroic and transcend death, every culture must provide its members with an intricate symbolic system that is covertly religious. This means that ideological conflicts between cultures are essentially battles between immortality projects, holy wars. One of Becker's lasting contributions to social psychology has been to help us understand that corporations and nations may be driven by unconscious motives that have little to do with their stated goals. Making a killing in business or on the battlefield frequently has less to do with economic need or political reality than with the need for assuring ourselves that we have achieved something of lasting worth. Consider, for instance, the recent war in Vietnam, in which the United States was driven not by any realistic economic or political interest, but by the overwhelming need to defeat atheistic communism. The fourth strand. Our heroic projects that are aimed at destroying evil have the paradoxical effect of bringing more evil into the world. Human conflicts are life and death struggles. My gods against your gods. My immortality project against your immortality project. The root of humanly caused evil is not man's animal nature, not territorial aggression or innate selfishness, but our need to gain self-esteem, deny our mortality, and achieve a heroic self-image. Our desire for the best is the cause of the worst. We want to clean up the world, make it perfect, keep it safe for democracy or communism, purify it of the enemies of God, eliminate evil, establish an alabaster city undimmed by human tears, or a thousand-year Reich. Perhaps Becker's greatest achievement has been to create a science of evil. He has given us a new way to understand how we create surplus evil, warfare, ethnic cleansing, genocide. From the beginning of time, humans have dealt with what Carl Jung called their shadow side, feelings of inferiority, self-hate, guilt, hostility, by projecting it onto an enemy. It has remained for Becker to make crystal clear the way in which warfare is a social ritual for purification of the world in which the enemy is assigned the role of being dirty, dangerous, and atheistic. Dachau, Cape Town, and Mili, Bosnia, Rwanda, give grim testimony to the universal need for a scapegoat. A Jew, a nigger, a dirty communist, a Muslim, a Tutsi. Warfare is a death potlatch in which we sacrifice our brave boys to destroy the cowardly enemies of righteousness. And the more blood, the better, because the bigger the body count, the greater the sacrifice for the sacred cause, the side of destiny, the divine plan. Becker's radical conclusion that it is our altruistic motives that turn the world into a charnel house, our desire to merge with a larger whole, to dedicate our lives to a higher cause, to serve cosmic powers, poses a disturbing and revolutionary question to every individual and nation. At what cost do we purchase the assurance that we are heroic? No doubt one of the reasons Becker has never found a mass audience is because he shames us with the knowledge of how easily we will shed blood to purchase the assurance of our own righteousness. He reveals how our need to deny our nakedness and be arrayed in glory keeps us from acknowledging that the emperor has no clothes. After such a grim diagnosis of the human condition, it is not surprising that Becker offers only a palliative prescription. Expect no miracle cure, no future apotheosis of man, no enlightened future, no triumph of reason. Becker sketches two possible styles of non-destructive heroism. The best we can hope for society at large is that the mass of unconscious individuals might develop a moral equivalent to war. The science of man has shown us that society will always be composed of passive subjects, powerful leaders, and enemies upon whom we project our guilt and self-hatred. This knowledge may allow us to develop an objective hatred, in which the hate object is not a human scapegoat, but something impersonal like poverty, disease, oppression, or natural disasters. By making our inevitable hatred intelligent and informed, we may be able to turn our destructive energy to a creative use. For the exceptional individual, there is the ancient philosophical path of wisdom. Becker, like Socrates, advises us to practice dying. Cultivating awareness of our death leads to disillusionment, loss of character armor, and a conscious choice to abide in the face of terror. The existential hero who follows this way of self-analysis differs from the average person in knowing that he/she is obsessed. Instead of hiding within the illusions of character, he sees his impotence and vulnerability. The disillusioned hero rejects the standardized heroics of mass culture in favor of cosmic heroism, in which there is real joy in throwing off the chains of uncritical, self-defeating dependency and discovering new possibilities of choice and action, and new forms of courage and endurance. Living with the voluntary consciousness of death, the heroic individual can choose to despair or to make a Kierkegaardian leap and trust in the sacrosanct vitality of the cosmos, in the unknown God of life whose mysterious purpose is expressed in the overwhelming drama of cosmic evolution. There are signs, the acceptance of Becker's work being one, that some individuals are awakening from the long, dark night of tribalism and nationalism and developing what Tillich called a transmoral conscience, an ethic that is universal rather than ethnic. Our task for the future is exploring what it means for each individual to be a member of Earth's household, a commonwealth of kindred beings. Whether we will use our freedom to encapsulate ourselves in narrow, tribal, paranoid personalities and create more bloody utopias, or to form compassionate communities of the abandoned, is still to be decided. So long as human beings possess a measure of freedom, all hopes for the future must be stated in the subjunctive. We may, we might, we could. No prediction by any expert can tell us whether we will prosper or perish. We may choose to increase or decrease the dominion of evil. The script for tomorrow is not yet written. In the end, Becker leaves us with a hope that is terribly fragile and wonderfully potent. It is, he says, the disguise of panic that makes us live in ugliness, and not the natural animal wallowing. And this means that evil itself is amenable to critical analysis, and conceivably to the sway of reason. If, in some distant future, reason conquers our habit of self-destructive heroics, and we are able to lessen the quantity of evil we spawn, it will be in some large measure because Ernest Becker helped us understand the relationship between the denial of death and the dominion of evil. Those interested in the ways Becker's work is being used and continued by philosophers, social scientists, psychologists, and theologians may contact the Ernest Becker Foundation, 3621 72nd Street, Mercer Island, Washington, 98040, and receive a newsletter and notification of lectures and conferences. Sam Keen. Preface. For the time being, I gave up writing. There was already too much truth in the world, and overproduction which apparently cannot be consumed. Otto Rank. The prospect of death, Dr. Johnson said, wonderfully concentrates the mind. The main thesis of this book is that it does much more than that. The idea of death, the fear of it, haunts the human animal like nothing else. It is a mainspring of human activity, activity designed largely to avoid the fatality of death, to overcome it by denying in some way that it is the final destiny for man. The noted anthropologist A.M. Hocart once argued that primitives were not bothered by the fear of death, that a sagacious sampling of anthropological evidence would show that death was, more often than not, accompanied by rejoicing and festivities, that death seemed to be an occasion for celebration rather than fear, much like the traditional Irish wake. Hocart wanted to dispel the notion that, compared to modern man, primitives were childish and frightened by reality. Anthropologists have now largely accomplished this rehabilitation of the primitive. But this argument leaves untouched the fact that the fear of death is indeed a universal in the human condition. To be sure, primitives often celebrate death, as Hocart and others have shown, because they believe that death is the ultimate promotion, the final ritual elevation to a higher form of life, to the enjoyment of eternity in some form. Most modern Westerners have trouble believing this anymore, which is what makes the fear of death so prominent a part of our psychological makeup. In these pages, I try to show that the fear of death is a universal that unites data from several disciplines of the human sciences and makes wonderfully clear and intelligible human actions that we have buried under mountains of fact and obscured with endless back-and-forth arguments about the true human motives. The man of knowledge in our time is bowed down under a burden he never imagined he would ever have, the overproduction of truth that cannot be consumed. For centuries, man lived in the belief that truth was slim and elusive, and that once he found it, the troubles of mankind would be over. And here we are in the closing decades of the 20th century, choking on truth. There has been so much brilliant writing, so many genial discoveries, so vast an extension and elaboration of these discoveries, yet the mind is silent as the world spins on its age-old demonic career. I remember reading how, at the famous St. Louis World Exposition in 1904, the speaker at the prestigious science meeting was having trouble speaking against the noise of the new weapons that were being demonstrated nearby. He said something condescending and tolerant about this needlessly disruptive play, as though the future belonged to science and not to militarism. World War I showed everyone the priority of things on this planet, which party was playing idle games and which wasn't. This year, the order of priority was again graphically shown by a world arms budget of $204 billion, at a time when human living conditions on the planet were worse than ever. Why, then, the reader may ask, add still another weighty tome to a useless overproduction? Well, there are personal reasons, of course, habit, drivenness, dogged hopefulness. And there is eros, the urge to the unification of experience, to form, to greater meaningfulness. One of the reasons I believe that knowledge is in a state of useless overproduction is that it is strewn all over the place, spoken in a thousand competitive voices. Its insignificant fragments are magnified all out of proportion, while its major and world historical insights lie around begging for attention. There is no throbbing vital center. Norman O'Brown observed that the great world needs more eros and less strife, and the intellectual world needs it just as much. There has to be revealed the harmony that unites many different positions, so that the sterile and ignorant polemics can be abated. I have written this book fundamentally as a study in harmonization of the babble of views on man and on the human condition, in the belief that the time is ripe for a synthesis that covers the best thought in many fields, from the human sciences to religion. I have tried to avoid moving against and negating any point of view, no matter how personally antipathetic to me, if it seems to have in it a core of truthfulness. I have had the growing realization over the past few years that the problem of man's knowledge is not to oppose and to demolish opposing views, but to include them in a larger theoretical structure. One of the ironies of the creative process is that it partly cripples itself in order to function. I mean that usually, in order to turn out a piece of work, the author has to exaggerate the emphasis of it, to oppose it in a forcefully competitive way to other versions of truth, and he gets carried away by his own exaggeration, as his distinctive image is built on it. But each honest thinker, who is basically an empiricist, has to have some truth in his position, no matter how extremely he has formulated it. The problem is to find the truth underneath the exaggeration, to cut away the excess elaboration or distortion, and include that truth where it fits. A second reason for my writing this book is that I have had more than my share of problems with this fitting together of valid truths in the past dozen years. I have been trying to come to grips with the ideas of Freud and his interpreters and heirs, with what might be the distillation of modern psychology, and now I think I have finally succeeded. In this sense, this book is a bid for the peace of my scholarly soul, an offering for intellectual absolution. I feel that it is my first mature work. One of the main things I try to do in this book is to present a summing up of psychology after Freud by tying the whole development of psychology back to the still towering Kierkegaard. I am thus arguing for a merger of psychology and mythico-religious perspective. I base this argument in large part on the work of Otto Rank, and I have made a major attempt to transcribe the relevance of his magnificent edifice of thought. This coming to grips with Rank's work is long overdue, and if I have succeeded in it, it probably comprises the main value of the book. Rank is so prominent in these pages that perhaps a few words of introduction about him would be helpful here. Frederick Perls once observed that Rank's book, Art and Artist, was beyond praise. I remember being so struck by this judgment that I went immediately to the book. I couldn't very well imagine how anything scientific could be beyond praise. Even the work of Freud himself seemed to me to be praiseworthy, that is, somehow expectable as a product of the human mind. But Perls was right. Rank was, as the young people say, something else. You cannot merely praise much of his work, because in its stunning brilliance it is often fantastic, gratuitous, superlative. The insights seem like a gift, beyond what is necessary. I suppose part of the reason, in addition to his genius, was that Rank's thought always spanned several fields of knowledge. When he talked about, say, anthropological data, and you expected anthropological insight, you got something else, something more. Living as we do in an era of hyper-specialization, we have lost the expectation of this kind of delight. The experts give us manageable thrills, if they thrill us at all. One thing that I hope my confrontation of Rank will do is to send the reader directly to his books. There is no substitute for reading Rank. My personal copies of his books are marked in the covers with an uncommon abundance of notes, underlinings, double exclamation points. He is a mine for years of insights and pondering. My treatment of Rank is merely an outline of his thought, its foundations, many of its basic insights, and its overall implications. This will be the pale Rank, not the staggeringly rich one of his books. Also, Ira Progoff's outline presentation and appraisal of Rank is so correct, so finely balanced in judgment, that it can hardly be improved upon as a brief appreciation. Rank is very diffuse, very hard to read, so rich that he is almost inaccessible to the general reader. He was painfully aware of this and for a time hoped that Anaïs Nin would rewrite his books for him so that they would have a chance to have the effect they should have had. What I give in these pages is my own version of Rank, filled out in my own way, a sort of brief translation of his system in the hope of making it accessible as a whole. In this book, I cover only his individual psychology. In another book, I will sketch his schema for a psychology of history. There are several ways of looking at Rank. Some see him as a brilliant co-worker of Freud, a member of the early circle of psychoanalysis, who helped give it broader currency by bringing to it his own vast erudition, who showed how psychoanalysis could illuminate culture, history, myth, and legend, as, for example, in his early work on the myth of the birth of the hero and the incest motif. They would go on to say that because Rank was never analyzed, his repressions gradually got the better of him, and he turned away from the stable and creative life he had close to Freud. In his later years, his personal instability gradually overcame him, and he died prematurely in frustration and loneliness. Others see Rank as an overeager disciple of Freud, who tried prematurely to be original and, in so doing, even exaggerated psychoanalytic reductionism. This judgment is based almost solely on his 1924 book, The Trauma of Birth, and usually stops there. Still others see Rank as a brilliant member of Freud's close circle, an eager favorite of Freud, whose university education was suggested and financially helped by Freud, and who repaid psychoanalysis with insights into many fields: cultural history, childhood development, the psychology of art, literary criticism, primitive thought, and so on. In short, a sort of many-faceted but not too well-organized or self-controlled boy wonder. An intellectually superior Theodor Reich, so to speak. But all these ways of summing up Rank are wrong, and we know that they derive largely from the mythology of the circle of psychoanalysts themselves. They never forgave Rank for turning away from Freud and so diminishing their own immortality symbol, to use Rank's way of understanding their bitterness and pettiness. Admittedly, Rank's trauma of birth gave his detractors an easy handle on him, a justified reason for disparaging his stature. It was an exaggerated and ill-fated book that poisoned his public image, even though he himself reconsidered it and went so far beyond it. Not being merely a co-worker of Freud, a broad-ranging servant of psychoanalysis, Rank had his own unique and perfectly thought-out system of ideas. He knew where he wanted to begin, what body of data he had to pass through, and where it all pointed. He knew these things specifically as regards psychoanalysis itself, which he wanted to transcend and did. He knew it roughly, as regards the philosophical implications of his own system of thought. But he was not given the time to work this out, as his life was cut short. He was certainly as complete a system maker as were Adler and Jung. His system of thought is at least as brilliant as theirs, if not more so in some ways. We respect Adler for the solidity of his judgment, the directness of his insight, his uncompromising humanism. We admire Jung for the courage and openness with which he embraced both science and religion. But even more than these two, Rank's system has implications for the deepest and broadest development of the social sciences, implications that have only begun to be tapped. Paul Rosen, writing about the legend of Freud, aptly observed that any writer whose mistakes have taken this long to correct is quite a figure in intellectual history. Yet the whole matter is very curious, because Adler, Jung, and Rank very early corrected most of Freud's basic mistakes. The question for the historian is, rather, what there was in the nature of the psychoanalytic movement, the ideas themselves, the public and the scholarly mind, that kept these corrections so ignored or so separated from the main movement of cumulative scientific thought? Even a book of broad scope has to be very selective of the truths it picks out of the mountain of truth that is stifling us. Many thinkers of importance are mentioned only in passing. The reader may wonder, for example, why I lean so much on Rank and hardly mention Jung in a book that has as a major aim the closure of psychoanalysis on religion. One reason is that Jung is so prominent and has so many effective interpreters, while Rank is hardly known and has had hardly anyone to speak for him. Another reason is that although Rank's thought is difficult, it is always right on the central problems. Jung's is not, and a good part of it wanders into needless esotericism. The result is that he often obscures on the one hand what he reveals on the other. I can't see that all his tomes on alchemy add one bit to the weight of his psychoanalytic insight. A good many phrasings of insight into human nature I owe to exchanges with Marie Becker, whose fineness and realism on these matters are most rare. I want to thank, with the customary disclaimers, Paul Rosen for his kindness in passing Chapter 6 through the net of his great knowledge of Freud. Robert N. Bella read the entire manuscript, and I am very grateful for his general criticisms and specific suggestions. Those that I was able to act on definitely improved the book. As for the others, I fear that they pose the larger and longer-range task of changing myself. Chapter 1. Introduction. Human Nature and the Heroic. In times such as ours, there is a great pressure to come up with concepts that help men understand their dilemma. There is an urge toward vital ideas, toward a simplification of needless intellectual complexity. Sometimes this makes for big lies that resolve tensions and make it easy for action to move forward with just the rationalizations that people need. But it also makes for the slow disengagement of truths that help men get a grip on what is happening to them, that tell them where the problems really are. One such vital truth that has long been known is the idea of heroism, But in normal, scholarly times, we never thought of making much out of it, of parading it, or of using it as a central concept. Yet the popular mind always knew how important it was, as William James, who covered just about everything, remarked at the turn of the century, "Mankind's common instinct for reality has always held the world to be essentially a theater for heroism." Not only the popular mind knew, but philosophers of all ages, and in our culture, especially Emerson and Nietzsche, which is why we still thrill to them. We like to be reminded that our central calling, our main task on this planet, is the heroic. Note: in the following discussion, I am obliged to repeat and sum up things I have written elsewhere. The Birth and Death of Meaning, 2nd edition, New York, Free Press, 1971. In order to set the framework for the other chapters. End of note. One way of looking at the whole development of social science since Marx and of psychology since Freud is that it represents a massive detailing and clarification of the problem of human heroism. This perspective sets the tone for the seriousness of our discussion. We now have the scientific underpinning for a true understanding of the nature of heroism and its place in human life. If mankind's common instinct for reality is right, we have achieved the remarkable feat of exposing that reality in a scientific way. One of the key concepts for understanding man's urge to heroism is the idea of narcissism. As Erich Fromm has so well reminded us, this idea is one of Freud's great and lasting contributions. Freud discovered that each of us repeats the tragedy of the mythical Greek Narcissus. We are hopelessly absorbed with ourselves. If we care about anyone, it is usually ourselves first of all. As Aristotle somewhere put it, luck is when the guy next to you gets hit with the arrow. 2,500 years of history have not changed man's basic narcissism. Most of the time, for most of us, this is still a workable definition of luck. It is one of the meaner aspects of narcissism that we feel that practically everyone is expendable except ourselves. We should feel prepared, as Emerson once put it, to recreate the whole world out of ourselves, even if no one else existed. The thought frightens us. We don't know how we could do it without others. Yet, at bottom, the basic resource is there. We could suffice alone if need be, if we could trust ourselves as Emerson wanted. And if we don't feel this trust emotionally, still most of us would struggle to survive with all our powers, no matter how many around us died. Our organism is ready to fill the world all alone, even if our mind shrinks at the thought. This narcissism is what keeps men marching into point-blank fire in wars. At heart, one doesn't feel that he will die. He only feels sorry for the man next to him. Freud's explanation for this was that the unconscious does not know death or time. In man's physiochemical, inner organic recesses, he feels immortal. None of these observations implies human guile. Man does not seem able to help his selfishness. It seems to come from his animal nature. Through countless ages of evolution, the organism has had to protect its own integrity. It had its own physiochemical identity and was dedicated to preserving it. This is one of the main problems in organ transplants. The organism protects itself against foreign matter, even if it is a new heart that would keep it alive. The protoplasm itself harbors its own, nurtures itself against the world, against invasions of its integrity. It seems to enjoy its own pulsations, expanding into the world and ingesting pieces of it. If you took a blind and dumb organism and gave it self-consciousness and a name, if you made it stand out of nature and know consciously that it was unique, then you would have narcissism. In man, physiochemical identity and the sense of power and activity have become conscious. In man, a working level of narcissism is inseparable from self-esteem, from a basic sense of self-worth. We have learned, mostly from Alfred Adler, that what man needs most is to feel secure in his self-esteem. But man is not just a blind glob of idling protoplasm, but a creature with a name, who lives in a world of symbols and dreams and not merely matter. His sense of self-worth is constituted symbolically. His cherished narcissism feeds on symbols, on an abstract idea of his own worth, an idea composed of sounds, words, and images, in the air, in the mind, on paper. And this means that man's natural yearning for organismic activity, the pleasures of incorporation and expansion, can be fed limitlessly in the domain of symbols, and so into immortality. The single organism can expand into dimensions of worlds and times without moving a physical limb. It can take eternity into itself, even as it gaspingly dies. In childhood, we see the struggle for self-esteem at its least disguised. The child is unashamed about what he needs and wants most. His whole organism shouts the claims of his natural narcissism. And this claim can make childhood hellish for the adults concerned, especially when there are several children competing at once for the prerogatives of limitless self-extension, what we might call cosmic significance. The term is not meant to be taken lightly, because this is where our discussion is leading. We like to speak casually about sibling rivalry, as though it were some kind of byproduct of growing up, a bit of competitiveness and selfishness of children who have been spoiled, who haven't yet grown into a generous, social nature. But it is too all-absorbing and relentless to be an aberration. It expresses the heart of the creature, the desire to stand out, to be the one in creation. When you combine natural narcissism with the basic need for self-esteem, you create a creature who has to feel himself an object of primary value, first in the universe, representing in himself all of life. This is the reason for the daily and usually excruciating struggle with siblings. The child cannot allow himself to be second best or devalued, much less left out. You gave him the biggest piece of candy. You gave him more juice. Here's a little more then. Now she's got more juice than me. You let her light the fire in the fireplace and not me. Okay, you light a piece of paper. But this piece of paper is smaller than the one she lit. And so on and on. An animal who gets his feeling of worth, symbolically, has to minutely compare himself to those around him to make sure he doesn't come off second best. Sibling rivalry is a critical problem that reflects the basic human condition. It is not that children are vicious, selfish, or domineering. It is that they so openly express man's tragic destiny. He must desperately justify himself as an object of primary value in the universe. He must stand out, be a hero, make the biggest possible contribution to world life, show that he counts more than anything or anyone else. When we appreciate how natural it is for man to strive to be a hero, how deeply it goes in his evolutionary and organismic constitution, how openly he shows it as a child, then it is all the more curious how ignorant most of us are, consciously, of what we really want and need. In our culture anyway, especially in modern times, the heroic seems too big for us, or we too small for it. Tell a young man that he is entitled to be a hero and he will blush. We disguise our struggle by piling up figures in a bank book to reflect privately our sense of heroic worth, or by having only a little better home in the neighborhood, a bigger car, brighter children. But underneath throbs the ache of cosmic specialness, no matter how we mask it in concerns of smaller scope. Occasionally someone admits that he takes his heroism seriously, which gives most of us a chill, as did U.S. Congressman Mendel Rivers, who fed appropriations to the military machine and said he was the most powerful man since Julius Caesar. We may shudder at the crassness of earthly heroism, of both Caesar and his imitators, but the fault is not theirs. It is in the way society sets up its hero system, and in the people it allows to fill its roles. The urge to heroism is natural, and to admit it, honest. For everyone to admit it, would probably release such pent-up force as to be devastating to societies as they now are. The fact is that this is what society is and always has been, a symbolic action system, a structure of statuses and roles, customs and rules for behavior, designed to serve as a vehicle for earthly heroism. Each script is somewhat unique. Each culture has a different hero system. What the anthropologists call cultural relativity is thus really the relativity of hero systems the world over. But each cultural system is a dramatization of earthly heroics. Each system cuts out roles for performances of various degrees of heroism, from the high heroism of a Churchill, a Mao, or a Buddha, to the low heroism of the coal miner, the peasant, the simple priest, the plain everyday earthy heroism wrought by gnarled working hands guiding a family through hunger and disease. It doesn't matter whether the cultural hero system is frankly magical, religious, and primitive or secular, scientific, and civilized. It is still a mythical hero system in which people serve in order to earn a feeling of primary value, of cosmic specialness, of ultimate usefulness to creation, of unshakable meaning. They earn this feeling by carving out a place in nature, by building an edifice that reflects human value, a temple, a cathedral, a totem pole, a skyscraper, a family that spans three generations. The hope and belief is that the things that man creates in society are of lasting worth and meaning, that they outlive or outshine death and decay, that man and his products count. When Norman O. Brown said that Western society since Newton, no matter how scientific or secular it claims to be, is still as religious as any other, this is what he meant. Civilized society is a hopeful belief and protest that science, money, and goods make man count for more than any other animal. In this sense, everything that man does is religious and heroic, and yet in danger of being fictitious and fallible. The question that becomes then the most important one that man can put to himself is simply this. How conscious is he of what he is doing to earn his feeling of heroism? I suggested that if everyone honestly admitted his urge to be a hero, it would be a devastating release of truth. It would make men demand that culture give them their due, a primary sense of human value as unique contributors to cosmic life. How would our modern societies contrive to satisfy such an honest demand without being shaken to their foundations? Only those societies we today call primitive provided this feeling for their members. The minority groups in present-day industrial society who shout for freedom and human dignity are really clumsily asking that they be given a sense of primary heroism of which they have been cheated historically. This is why their insistent claims are so troublesome and upsetting. How do we do such an unreasonable thing within the ways in which society is now set up? They are asking for the impossible, is the way we usually put our bafflement. But the truth about the need for heroism is not easy for anyone to admit, even the very ones who want to have their claims recognized. There's the rub. As we shall see from our subsequent discussion, to become conscious of what one is doing to earn his feeling of heroism is the main self-analytic problem of life. Everything painful and sobering in what psychoanalytic genius and religious genius have discovered about man revolves around the terror of admitting what one is doing to earn his self-esteem. This is why human heroics is a blind drivenness that burns people up. In passionate people, a screaming for glory as uncritical and reflexive as the howling of a dog. In the more passive masses of mediocre men, it is disguised as they humbly and complainingly follow out the roles that society provides for their heroics and try to earn their promotions within the system, wearing the standard uniforms, but allowing themselves to stick out, but ever so little and so safely, with a little ribbon or a red boutonniere, but not with head and shoulders. If we were to peel away this massive disguise, the blocks of repression over human techniques for earning glory, we would arrive at the potentially most liberating question of all, the main problem of human life. How empirically true is the cultural hero system that sustains and drives men? We mentioned the meaner side of man's urge to cosmic heroism, but there is obviously the noble side as well. Man will lay down his life for his country, his society, his family. He will choose to throw himself on a grenade to save his comrades. He is capable of the highest generosity and self-sacrifice. But he has to feel and believe that what he is doing is truly heroic, timeless, and supremely meaningful. The crisis of modern society is precisely that the youth no longer feel heroic in the plan for action that their culture has set up. They don't believe it is empirically true to the problems of their lives and times. We are living a crisis of heroism that reaches into every aspect of our social life. The dropouts of university heroism, of business and career heroism, of political action heroism, the rise of anti-heroes, those who would be heroic each in his own way, or like Charles Manson with his special family, those whose tormented heroics lash out at the system that itself has ceased to represent agreed heroism. The great perplexity of our time, the churning of our age, is that the youth have sensed, for better or for worse, a great social historical truth. that just as there are useless self-sacrifices in unjust wars, so too is there an ignoble heroics of whole societies. It can be the viciously destructive heroics of Hitler's Germany, or the plain debasing and silly heroics of the acquisition and display of consumer goods, the piling up of money and privileges that now characterizes whole ways of life, capitalist and Soviet. And the crisis of society is, of course, the crisis of organized religion, too. Religion is no longer valid as a hero system, and so the youth scorn it. If traditional culture is discredited as heroics, then the church that supports that culture automatically discredits itself. If the church, on the other hand, chooses to insist on its own special heroics, it might find that in crucial ways it must work against the culture, recruit youth to be anti-heroes to the ways of life of the society they live in. This is the dilemma of religion in our time. Conclusion. What I have tried to do in this brief introduction is to suggest that the problem of heroics is the central one of human life, that it goes deeper into human nature than anything else, because it is based on organismic narcissism and on the child's need for self-esteem as the condition for his life. Society itself is a codified hero system, which means that society everywhere is a living myth of the significance of human life, a defiant creation of meaning. Every society, thus, is a religion, whether it thinks so or not. Soviet religion and Maoist religion are as truly religious as are scientific and consumer religion, no matter how much they may try to disguise themselves by omitting religious and spiritual ideas from their lives. As we shall see further on, it was Otto Rank who showed psychologically this religious nature of all human cultural creation. And more recently, the idea was revived by Norman O'Brown in his Life Against Death, and by Robert J. Lifton in his Revolutionary Immortality. If we accept these suggestions, then we must admit that we are dealing with the universal human problem, and we must be prepared to probe into it as honestly as possible, to be as shocked by the self-revelation of man as the best thought will allow. Let us pick this thought up with Kierkegaard and take it through Freud, to see where this stripping down of the last 150 years will lead us. If the penetrating honesty of a few books could immediately change the world, then the five authors just mentioned would already have shaken the nations to their foundations. But since everyone is carrying on as though the vital truths about man did not yet exist, it is necessary to add still another weight in the scale of human self-exposure. For 2,500 years, we have hoped and believed that if mankind could reveal itself to itself, could widely come to know its own cherished motives, then somehow it would tilt the balance of things in its own favor. Part 1. The Depth Psychology of Heroism. I drink not from mere joy in wine, nor to scoff at faith. No, only to forget myself for a moment. That only do I want of intoxication. That alone. Omar Khayyam. Chapter 2. The Terror of Death. Is it not for us to confess that in our civilized attitude towards death, we are once more living psychologically beyond our means, and must reform and give truth its due? Would it not be better to give death the place in actuality, and in our thoughts which properly belongs to it, and to yield a little more prominence to that unconscious attitude towards death which we have hitherto so carefully suppressed? This hardly seems indeed a greater achievement, but rather a backward step. But it has the merit of taking somewhat more into account the true state of affairs. Sigmund Freud. The first thing we have to do with heroism is to lay bare its underside. Show what gives human heroics its specific nature and impetus. Here we introduce directly one of the great rediscoveries of modern thought, that of all things that move man, one of the principal ones is his terror of death. After Darwin, the problem of death as an evolutionary one came to the fore, and many thinkers immediately saw that it was a major psychological problem for man. They also very quickly saw what real heroism was about. As Shaler wrote just at the turn of the century, heroism is first and foremost a reflex of the terror of death. We admire most the courage to face death. We give such valor our highest and most constant adoration. It moves us deeply in our hearts, because we have doubts about how brave we ourselves would be. When we see a man bravely facing his own extinction, we rehearse the greatest victory we can imagine. And so the hero has been the center of human honor and acclaim since probably the beginning of specifically human evolution. But even before that, our primate ancestors deferred to others who were extra powerful and courageous, and ignored those who were cowardly. Man has elevated animal courage into a cult. Anthropological and historical research also began, in the 19th century, to put together a picture of the heroic since primitive and ancient times. The hero was the man who could go into the spirit world, the world of the dead, and return alive. He had his descendants in the mystery cults of the Eastern Mediterranean, which were cults of death and resurrection. The divine hero of each of these cults was one who had come back from the dead. And as we know today from the research into ancient myths and rituals, Christianity itself was a competitor with the mystery cults and won out, among other reasons, because it, too, featured a healer with supernatural powers who had risen from the dead. The great triumph of Easter is the joyful shout, "Christ has risen," an echo of the same joy that the devotees of the mystery cults enacted at their ceremonies of the victory over death. These cults, as G. Stanley Hall so aptly put it, were an attempt to attain an immunity bath from the greatest evil, death, and the dread of it. All historical religions address themselves to this same problem of how to bear the end of life. Religions like Hinduism and Buddhism perform the ingenious trick of pretending not to want to be reborn, which is a sort of negative magic, claiming not to want what you really want most. When philosophy took over from religion, it also took over religion's central problem, and death became the real muse of philosophy from its beginnings in Greece right through Heidegger and modern existentialism. We already have volumes of work and thought on the subject from religion and philosophy, and, since Darwin, from science itself. The problem is how to make sense out of it. The accumulation of research and opinion on the fear of death is already too large to be dealt with and summarized in any simple way. The revival of interest in death in the last few decades has alone already piled up a formidable literature, and this literature does not point in any single direction. The healthy-minded argument. There are healthy-minded persons who maintain that fear of death is not a natural thing for man, that we are not born with it. An increasing number of careful studies on how the actual fear of death develops in the child agree fairly well that the child has no knowledge of death until about the age of 3 to 5. How could he? It is too abstract an idea, too removed from his experience. He lives in a world that is full of living, acting things, responding to him, amusing him, feeding him. He doesn't know what it means for life to disappear forever, nor theorize where it would go. Only gradually does he recognize that there is a thing called death that takes some people away forever. Very reluctantly, he comes to admit that it sooner or later takes everyone away. But this gradual realization of the inevitability of death can take up until the 9th or 10th year. If the child has no knowledge of an abstract idea like absolute negation, he does not have his own anxieties. He is absolutely dependent on the mother, experiences loneliness when she is absent, frustration when he is deprived of gratification, irritation at hunger and discomfort, and so on. If he were abandoned to himself, his world would drop away, and his organism must sense this at some level. We call this the anxiety of object loss. Isn't this anxiety, then, a natural, organismic fear of annihilation? Again, there are many who look at this as a very relative matter. They believe that if the mother has done her job in a warm and dependable way, the child's natural anxieties and guilts will develop in a moderate way, and he will be able to place them firmly under the control of his developing personality. The child who has good maternal experiences will develop a sense of basic security and will not be subject to morbid fears of losing support, of being annihilated, or the like. As he grows up to understand death rationally by the age of 9 or 10, he will accept it as part of his world view, but the idea will not poison his self-confident attitude toward life. The psychiatrist Reingold says categorically that annihilation anxiety is not part of the child's natural experience, but is engendered in him by bad experiences with a depriving mother. This theory puts the whole burden of anxiety onto the child's nurture and not his nature. Another psychiatrist, in a less extreme vein, sees the fear of death as greatly heightened by the child's experiences with his parents, by their hostile denial of his life impulses, and more generally, by the antagonism of society to human freedom and self-expansiveness. As we will see later on, this view is very popular today in the widespread movement toward unrepressed living, the urge to a new freedom for natural biological urges, a new attitude of pride and joy in the body, the abandonment of shame, guilt, and self-hatred. From this point of view, fear of death is something that society creates and at the same time uses against the person to keep him in submission. The psychiatrist Maloney talked about it as a culture mechanism, and Marcuse as an ideology. Norman O'Brown, in a vastly influential book that we shall discuss at some length, went so far as to say that there could be a birth and development of the child in a second innocence that would be free of the fear of death because it would not deny natural vitality and would leave the child fully open to physical living. It is easy to see that from this point of view, those who have bad early experiences will be most morbidly fixated on the anxiety of death. And if by chance they grow up to be philosophers, they will probably make the idea a central dictum of their thought, as did Schopenhauer, who both hated his mother and went on to pronounce death the muse of philosophy. If you have a sour character structure or especially tragic experiences, then you are bound to be pessimistic. One psychologist remarked to me that the whole idea of the fear of death was an import by existentialists and Protestant theologians who had been scarred by their European experiences or who carried around the extra weight of a Calvinist and Lutheran heritage of life denial. Even the distinguished psychologist Gardner Murphy seems to lean to this school and urges us to study the person who exhibits the fear of death, who places anxiety in the center of his thought. And Murphy asks why the living of life in love and joy cannot also be regarded as real and basic. The morbidly minded argument. The healthy-minded argument just discussed is one side of the picture of the accumulated research and opinion on the problem of the fear of death. But there is another side. A large body of people would agree with these observations on early experience and would admit that experiences may heighten natural anxieties and later fears, but these people would also claim very strongly that nevertheless the fear of death is natural and is present in everyone, that it is the basic fear that influences all others, a fear from which no one is immune, no matter how disguised it may be. William James spoke very early for this school, and with his usual colorful realism, he called death the worm at the core of man's pretensions to happiness. No less a student of human nature than Max Scheler thought that all men must have some kind of certain intuition of this worm at the core, whether they admitted it or not. Countless other authorities, some of whom we shall parade in the following pages, belong to this school. Students of the stature of Freud, many of his close circle, and serious researchers, who are not psychoanalysts. What are we to make of a dispute in which there are two distinct camps, both studded with distinguished authorities? Jacques Charon goes so far as to say that it is questionable whether it will ever be possible to decide whether the fear of death is or is not the basic anxiety. In matters like this, then, the most that one can do is to take sides, to give an opinion based on the authorities that seems to him most compelling, and to present some of the compelling arguments. I frankly side with this second school. In fact, this whole book is a network of arguments based on the universality of the fear of death, or terror, as I prefer to call it, in order to convey how all-consuming it is when we look it full in the face. The first document that I want to present and linger on is a paper written by the noted psychoanalyst Gregory Zilborg. It is an especially penetrating essay that, for succinctness and scope, has not been much improved upon, even though it appeared several decades ago. Zilborg says that most people think death fear is absent because it rarely shows its true face. But he argues that underneath all appearances, fear of death is universally present. For behind the sense of insecurity in the face of danger, behind the sense of discouragement and depression, there always lurks the basic fear of death, a fear which undergoes most complex elaborations and manifests itself in many indirect ways. No one is free of the fear of death. The anxiety neuroses, the various phobic states, even a considerable number of depressive suicidal states and many schizophrenias amply demonstrate the ever-present fear of death, which becomes woven into the major conflicts of the given psychopathological conditions. We may take for granted that the fear of death is always present in our mental functioning.